Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, March 27th, 2025, and sorry for being late. And welcome back, Laith. Let's get started. Laith, when it comes to the situation in Lebanon right now, and the Lebanese government said they're not going to normalize the relationship between Lebanon and Israel, how do you find the situation right now? Are they really honest in the way that they're talking about? How do you see the way that they're dealing with Hezbollah right now?
Well, obviously, if there is no resistance, if there is no Hezbollah in Lebanon, this new president and the new prime minister would follow the dictates of the American embassy, and they would normalize just like the other vassal Arab states around Palestine. The relationship right now between this new government and Hezbollah is very fragile. I think Hezbollah is letting them take as much space as possible to show the population that Hezbollah is willing to allow the Lebanese government, the Lebanese military, to control the borders, but just to also show people that the Lebanese military and the Lebanese government will not protect, actually, the border. So they're giving them a chance now, since the ceasefire, to deliver on their duties as a government and as a military to protect the territory of Lebanon and its borders. But as we see over the last week, even with the attacks by HTS on the north borders of Lebanon, the Lebanese military did not fight HTS. It was the local clans and tribes that fought HTS and protected Lebanon. And similarly, in the south of Lebanon, it was the Lebanese civilians that liberated their own villages by going into the villages with their bare, you know, bodies. And the Lebanese military is just watching. Again, so now anyone that had the idea that maybe because of the coming of Prime Minister Salam, who was the head of the International Court of Justice, that maybe this will give Lebanon its lands back, or that the Americans that like him or the West that likes him will treat him better and give the Lebanese lands, or try to prop up the Lebanese government by showing that it can protect the Lebanese territory. That's all now gone. Nobody can now lie to themselves and say that the Lebanese government will protect Lebanon somehow.
Laith, do you see the situation between the United States and Yemen influencing this, what's going on in Lebanon, or you don't see any sort of link between the two conflicts?
Well, definitely Yemen has filled the gap of Hezbollah, you know, accepting the ceasefire. And, you know, everybody was really worried about what's happening in Gaza, the resumption of the genocide, and how without any solidarity fronts will the Palestinians in Gaza survive. So Yemen stepping in and doing this on behalf of all of the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, is a great thing. People are watching as these ballistic missiles and these cruise missiles and drones and hypersonic missiles that Yemen is firing are affecting the Zionist colony and affecting the Ben Gurion airport. This is very important, I think, and as we see, the United States is having to re-engage in a direct battle with Yemen to protect the Zionist colony. And again, this is important because we can show the rest of the world that Yemen, who is delivering on its duties under the Genocide Convention, meaning to fight against genocide as a state, is being attacked now by the United States once more to allow the genocide to happen in Gaza.
Laith, what is When it comes to Yemen, and you mentioned about the genocide and the main goal of Yemenis, but how about the main goal of the United States going to Yemen again? Is that related to the way that they're seeing Iran, the way that Iran is influencing the axis of resistance, or is it something isolated and related to what's going on between Israel and Gaza, and maybe the United States wants to, I don't know, somehow destroy, they have this sort of idea of destroying Yemen's capabilities to fight back?
Yeah, I mean, we saw the leaked signal discussion group, and it's clear from the statements that officials in the U.S. government were making in this group that, you know, they want to destroy Yemen itself. They want to make sure that the government of Yemen, Ansarullah, are not able to defend themselves and or project power over the waterways in the Red Sea and the Arabian Sea. And one thing that I would note from this discussion on the signal group is how American officials themselves were saying that the blockade that Yemen has implemented does not really affect trade to the U.S. It's very little trade to the U.S. passes through the Red Sea, but that actually it is European Union members, European states that are damaged by the blockade that Yemen has implemented on the Red Sea. And therefore, the American officials themselves are admitting in this discussion on Signal that this is going to look bad, you know, because they're telling the media that they're going to stop subsidizing Europe and that Europe should protect itself and pay its share of the defense bill. And now, because, again, inside this discussion on the Signal group, they say that the European navies are unable to fight Ansarullah in Yemen, that actually the Yemenis have defeated the German, French, and British navies, and that only the United States has the capabilities to fight Yemen. So 100%, this is the United States doing this work on behalf of the EU, number one, and the Zionist colony, number two. It's nothing to do about Iran. They are eventually, in my opinion, they will be attacking Iran. The United States will be attacking Iran. The Israelis will be attacking Iran. Iran has to prepare for this. And it's going in stages, obviously, the axis of resistance. We lost Syria. Hezbollah was severely weakened, Hamas, the same thing, and now it's only Ansarullah and Iran that still stand in with full capabilities. So I don't think the U.S. will go to war in Iran before they deal with Yemen first.
But can they deal with Yemen? Because we know that history says they're not capable of defeating Yemen. And do you see any sort of sign that the Trump administration is bringing something new that make them capable of defeating Yemen?
You know, historically, obviously, there's not been any foreign power that occupied the mountains of Yemen or the capital, Sana'a, in 6,000, 12,000 years of recorded history. So it's very hard for the Americans to occupy Yemen. But as we saw, they have sent B-2 bombers and B-52 bombers to the region, which means that they want to use bunker buster, mother of all bombs and or nuclear weapons to hit the mountains in Yemen. That doesn't mean that they'll be able to occupy Yemen, but they will destroy huge swaths of the country and kill a lot of people. That's what Americans are good at. Will that stop the Yemenis from continuing to fire missiles at the Zionist colony or blockade the Bab al-Mandeb Strait? I'm not sure. But clearly the mountains in Yemen are so huge, you need something like the mother of all bombs or tactical nukes if you want to get to the missiles and the weapons inside those mountains. And that means we're opening up a new stage in this war. And if the U.S. dares to use such weapons, then it's clear that its bases and its interest in the region, meaning oil and gas facilities of the Gulf states, will be a legitimate target.
Not only that, I would argue if they use nukes in Yemen, Iran would change its strategy in terms of nuclear weapons. That would be game changer, in my opinion. That would destroy everything that the Trump administration is trying to do with Iran. Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, and I personally think that Iran should have nuclear weapons. Iran should right now rush and create as many nuclear heads as it can. That's the only deterrence. That's the only reason, for instance, that North Korea still exists. Otherwise, North Korea would have been dealt with the same way that Syria or Iraq or Libya have been dealt with. So I personally would encourage the Iranian government to create nuclear heads. And the other thing is that, we have now proof that the Israelis used tactical nukes in Syria in the Tartus Mountains and off the coast. In the week of the fall of President Assad's government in Syria, we have visual proof. We don't have actual, testing of the nuclear fallout in Yemen. But everybody remembers 6-7 years ago, the huge explosion in Sana'a. The image of it cannot be defined as anything but a nuclear tactical nuke use. So I think we're already living in that age, but nobody wants to admit it, especially the great powers that have nuclear arsenal don't want to admit that we are past this threshold of the use of tactical nukes, because it means that we will have to go directly into a nuclear war, and that means the Holocaust for all of humanity. But the audiences in the West that are watching us now must understand that, in Yemen, in Syria, it was used. And, this is the world we live in, that the lives of Arabs are so insignificant to the Western powers that they will use nuke and they wouldn't even mention it. And those who support even Syria, like Russia, wouldn't even dare say anything about it.
Leith, what do we know about Hezbollah right now? What are they talking about in terms of what's going on between the United States and Yemen, and even between the United States and Iran? Are they getting prepared? Are they prepared for everything that can happen to the axis of resistance? How are they talking about it? They're not that much talking about it.
Yeah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Naim Qasem, spoke just yesterday, and it's clear that we are entering a new stage now. Hezbollah is almost done reorganizing its structures and its weapons, and everybody's prepared for the return of full war, I believe. As we see in Gaza, the genocide is going to recommence, and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank continues nonstop. And the attacks on Syria and Lebanon by the Zionists continue on a daily basis. And so even if Hezbollah didn't want to re-engage in this war, the war is going to come to Hezbollah. And those, kind of opening shots that we saw in the north with the HTS, Wahhabi death squads trying to enter the country, those are all hints to what's coming. And I think what the Zionists are going to try to do with the Americans is have this combined attack on Lebanon by the Wahhabi death squads from Syria by the Israelis from the south, and maybe even some internal battle with some of the collaborators that are right now sleeper cells kind of situation that will be activated in the midst of such an attack on Lebanon. So I think Hezbollah has been preparing for the worst case scenario, and you know, the supply route is blockaded with the fall of Syria. So I wonder how Iran will, you know, react in a situation where there's a full war again in Lebanon. But I'm sure also that the leadership in Iran, watching what happened in Syria, watching what's happening in Gaza, and what's being cooked for Lebanon and or Yemen, they're all also getting ready for this inevitable war that is being forced on all of us.
What was amazing in the leaks, as you mentioned, the chat, the forum between the officials in the United States, you have the head of Pentagon, we had J.D. Vance, the vice president, Mike Waltz, all of them were talking. And how did it feel to you? Are they trying to intimidate? Are they trying to send a message? Or they're really getting to the point to get involved in a new war in the Middle East, which would be devastating, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know how factual this leak is. You know, let's remember that this was supposedly leaked to Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of the Atlantic magazine, who was a soldier in the Israeli military, you know, killing Palestinians and Lebanese people. And, you know, we know that there's a lot of things that are leaked on purpose. I personally, I'm not sure about everything in this chat, especially when we talk about how, you know, they were claiming that the head of the military, missile systems of Yemen was going into his girlfriend's apartment when they wanted to kill him, right? I mean, as we know, Ansarullah, you know, fashion themselves as a religious group. So to say that the head of their missile systems is going to check on his girlfriend, that's undermining his religiosity. So it sounds like, in my mind, it sounds like a propaganda ploy purposefully leaked to undermine the religiosity of this man. We don't have any confirmation of the killing of this man. The Yemenis, who are very proud, like Hezbollah, and of announcing their martyrs, they didn't announce any martyred general or whatever it is that is in charge of their missile program. Although I'm reading this and we're referring to it, it's still, I'm not 100% sure that any of this is true. Okay. The other thing is that clearly the you know, and if we believe it, if we take it on face value, then the you know, attacking a civilian building and killing everybody in it to kill a member of Ansarullah is a war crime in itself. So, you know, either the whole thing is a propaganda and it's designed to undermine Ansarullah, also to show that the United States is willing to kill as many civilians as possible, just like Israel. And on the other hand, to put more pressure on the Trump administration to engage in more wars and more killings on behalf of the Zionist colony. You see, these are all questions that I don't really have answers for. But ultimately, you know, if we forget even this text group, and we look at the history of what the United States has been doing in the region and how it engages in wars, then, you know, clearly the U.S. are war criminals. They're willing to kill, as you know, millions of people just to achieve their goals, and they're willing to do anything that Israel asks them to do, whether it's Trump or any other administration before them.
And the other point that is so much unknown, and I they were talking about the guy tracking the guy to the to his apartment, to I don't know his girlfriend's apartment, and just bombing the apartment, the building. Why, if they're able to track this guy, why is they're not killing them on the on his way to the apartment? Why do they need to kill civilians? And is that a question in your mind? Is that somehow, do they really think about it?
Yeah, I mean, look, we had the leaks from Gaza, from the Israeli military, using that AI tracking. I think it's called Deep Purple or Deep Violet or something like this. And Where's Daddy? Something like that. And they had programmed it on purpose to alert them when they go back to their residences where their family is, because they wanted to kill as many civilians with them, and specifically from the family members of the Hamas fighters or whatever it is. And that is something we have to all understand, that one of the main methods of colonialism is negative eugenics. Okay, maybe our listeners can understand the concept of eugenics, where you weed out bad genes, let's say before the birth or before the marriage or inception. And then the Nazis took it very far and started just culling and killing anybody that has disabilities or whatever it is, to clean up the gene pool. That's eugenics. And then there's negative eugenics, is when you purposefully target the elite of a society. It's doctors, it's lawyers, it's actors, it's artists, it's politicians. And not only you kill them, but you kill all their bloodline. Okay. This is because, there is a debate in science whether somebody like you, Nima, who is a good in their chosen work, like journalism, did you get this from your genes, from your parents, or did you get it from your environment, okay, that you became? So it's either nature or nurture, right? But when you work with negative eugenics, you don't have to answer that question. Because if you kill everybody that's related to one person, you have killed all their gene pool. Also, you've killed all their nurture. You know, maybe the stories that they would have been told about their great-grandfather that was a good guy and did this or that, or their father that was an example. So the Israelis are following this negative eugenics program against the Palestinians. And now it seems like the U.S. is following that path. And the U.S. did this, and Canada, by the way, did this to indigenous nations also. They would go, when they were at war with the indigenous nations, and kill all the bloodline of a leader purposefully. So nobody will rise from this family, either through the memory of the legacy of their great grandfathers and or through the genes that they that give them that edge to be leaders. So the U.S. is doing it on purpose, yes.
It was so amazing to me that the mindset, even somehow some analysts in the West are talking about that this is the end of the axis of resistance, this is the end to everything, they're going to be destroyed. But when you look at the history, it doesn't offer that. It doesn't say that. It shows that, it proves that the axis of resistance even existed before. They're talking about Iran. Let's focus on that. Iran is the main problem. But we know the acts of resistance existed before the revolution in Iran. It's not all about Iran. It's about the nature of this movement, that it doesn't die. It doesn't fade away. In order to deal with the main issue, which is the occupation, they're trying to somehow saying, now it's Yemen, let's fight Yemen, let's go to Iran. Maybe, I don't know. Do you think that even with the Trump administration, that he was totally, you remember how he was just going after some sort of propaganda, America first, and let's find, you don't see that mindset is changing in the United States. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so just so our viewers understand, the resistance to Zionism existed since the 1917, since the beginning of the Balfour Declaration being announced and World War One. So there was Palestinians and Syrians and Lebanese carrying arms against the British occupation in the 1920s and the 1930s. So it's 100 years ago. They were defeated, and the 1948 catastrophe, the Nakba, happened. People resisted. There was no Iran at that time. And that led to the rise of Jamal Abdel Nasser and Arab unificationist thought. And we had, the 1950s, the 1960s, and then the 1970s. And it was defeated, that project. But then out of the ashes of the Nasserite Arab unificationist came out the communist and socialist and the Ba'ath Party in Syria and the PFLP that fought in the camps and fought the Israelis, until the 1980s and their defeat. And then we had another, luckily, the rise of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. And we had this stage of fighting. And even if Iran is defeated, which I don't think Iran will be defeated, but let's say that every part of the axis of resistance is defeated. Let's say Yemen is defeated, Iran is defeated. From the ashes of those, from the slums of the refugee camps and the death camps in Gaza, another form of resistance will come out, another stage. And this is because the issue is very clear. It's occupation, it's colonization. And above and beyond that, it's usurpation of culture and heritage. The American elite, the Western elite, and want to claim that they represent Christianity and Jesus of Nazareth of Palestine and his religion, while they are working on the killing of Christians in Syria, in Lebanon, in Palestine, in Iraq. Okay, right now the only big Christian population left in the region is in Egypt, and I think their turn is going to come. Because our presence as Christians, and I'm not Christian, but the presence of Christian Arabs in the region is a reminder that European Christians are usurpers of the religion, that they don't really represent Jesus Christ, killing all these indigenous nations in the Americas and in Oceania in his name, the prophet of peace. Similarly, these Jewish Europeans that are descendants of converts are usurping the name of Moses of Egypt, the free liberator of slaves, and enslaving peoples around the whole region here in his name. So the struggle here is existential, is true, not only about existence of the countries or lands or liberation of land. No, it's existential of identity fully. As long as me as an Arab, who is the descendants of the original Jews, the original Christians, and the original Muslims, as long as I simply exist, I am a threat to them, because I expose the fact that they are fakes, and that are trying to tell the whole world that they speak on the behalf of Christianity and Judaism, while they are the worst thing that ever happened to Christianity and Judaism.
The other point that, in my opinion, they're missing is that doesn't matter what the government in Saudi Arabia, UAE, Turkey, and all of these, Egypt, are doing and are trying to picture about these countries. We know that what's going on the streets in these countries. We know how the public opinion is against the occupation. And do you think that comes to the equation that they're having right now, or it doesn't matter for them that what the people are feeling about the situation in Gaza, in Palestine?
Yeah, I mean, like the Americans, the West in general, seems like don't care about the opinions of their own people, right? Like we, you know, multiple surveys tell us that the vast majority of Europeans and North Americans are against the genocide, are against arming Israel, want to cut the funding and arming to Israel, but they don't care about their own population opinions. And so they look at their own population that is quiet. Yeah, a few demonstrations here or there, but nothing really that is affecting the business of the genocide, and the implementation and sending the weapons and what have you. So, of course, their view of the Arabic public is even less than their view of the Western public. So in their mind, if the Western public is unable to stop them, why would the Arab public be able to do anything? Because the Arab public is more repressed. You know, anyone that goes out for Palestine in the Saudi kingdom is thrown in the dungeons and tortured and killed. And therefore, they believe, the Western elite, that there's nothing to worry about in terms of the opinions of the public. And this is why, you know, at this moment, I think the ground is very ripe in the Arabic world for a birth of a new movement, of a liberation movement. It will build on the historical movements before it, but the stage is open right now. There's with the, you know, the fall of the Syrian government, and with Iran and Hezbollah withdrawing from Syria. Now, anyone that wants to talk about sectarianism, they can't find a reason to convince people. So anyone that was convinced that Syria, you know, Hezbollah and Iran are occupying Syria and the Shia are killing the Sunnis and so forth, now everybody is watching that there's, you know, Iran and Hezbollah, nobody, Shia is controlling Syria and or any other Arabic country, and they're still a slaughterhouse. There's still Israeli occupation. There's still sanctions. There's still the looting of our resources of Syria and Iraq. So from the ashes of that, right now the ground is fertile for the birth of a new movement, and so I think the pressure within the Arabic public that's building up is going to birth it. I can't predict where it's going to be. Maybe it's going to be even in a country that we don't have in our mind. You know, we would think Iraq or Syria would be a birth for a place for this. It could be Egypt that births something like this. It could be a general in Egypt decides to put a bullet in the head of Sisi and takes over and announces something, you know. This is how history works.
It seems, by the way, to deal with the issue of the public opinion in the Muslim countries, they have somehow the sort of movement to change the attitude, to influence the public opinion. They have it in the United States. Many of these people have been working, and we talk about the case of Mahmoud Khalil, as you've mentioned before. How do you see the role of these NGOs and the people who are working for NGOs in order to influence the public opinion in the Muslim countries?
Yeah, I mean, the USAID cutting all the funding was a great thing. It's now making a lot of those who work for the NGO circles in the Arabic world you know, think about what they're doing because they don't have funding. And look, I think something that as Muslims we don't talk about much, we talk about Jerusalem and Palestine being occupied. But truthfully, in World War I, also Mecca and Medina fell under occupation. And the same Hashemite family that allowed the British to occupy Palestine was the one that's in control of Mecca and Medina. And when the king of the Hashemites started having a problem with the British, they armed the Saud family in 1930, and they invaded Mecca and Medina and conducted a killing, you know, situation just like happened in Iraq and Syria, and destroyed all the shrines of all the wives and family of Muhammad and his companions in all of those cities. Now you can't even go see where the Prophet is buried, the cemetery there. What I'm trying to say here is that Islam also fell, the Muslim holy sites of Mecca and Medina fell under occupation at the end of World War I. And the Saudis have been propagating a false new imperialist, colonialist Islam as the West wishes to Islam to be in the same form as the Judaism and Christianity that we see coming from the West, this colonialist Judaism and colonialist Christianity. And for the most part, for the last 80 years, the Saudis haven't had a opponent to fight them in the Muslim countries about education, around what is Islam, what is the interpretation of what the Quran is, and so on. And this is why we have the Wahhabi death squads. The Saudis managed to brainwash a lot of Muslims in Central Asia, in South Asia, in Africa, to adopt this genocidal form of Islam that is actually in the image of European colonialism. And this is why Iran has been a big problem for the West, because Iran was, after the revolution, was projecting the true form of Islam, whether you're Sunni or Shia, even if you don't want to be Shia, Iran was projecting an Islam of liberation, an Islam of brotherhood, an Islam of fighting for the oppressed, not an oppressive Islam. And so, and this is what really the Saudis and the Israelis and the Europeans and the Americans want from Iran. They want from Iran to stop giving the rest of the Muslim world a understanding of Islam that is opposed to colonialism and imperialism.
Laith, just to wrap up this session, do you feel that the war between Iran and the United States is going to happen? And what if we assume that would happen? Well, how Iran would respond to these Arab states in the Persian Gulf, which we know that the bases of the United States are located there? And are they going to be hit by Iranian government, by Iranian military?
I think the war is inevitable. There's nothing that can stop it. And Iran would be smart if it took precautions and preemptive steps. Before they bombed Tehran or tried to kill assassinate the Ayatollah, the Americans would want to do that, the Israelis would want to do that. Before that happens, Iran should be creating more troubles in the region, whether it's opening a different front, even if it's not its own name. Right now the Wahhabi death squads in Syria are roaming free. There should be some resistance that is triggered, whether it's from the border in Iraq or other places. Yemen is going to be bombed. Well, let Yemen then attack Saudi oil facilities, Emirati oil facilities, destroy the capability of the US to have this never-ending supply of oil and gas and cash that's coming from the cash cows of the vessels in the Gulf before they attack Iran. Now, of course, I have no say in how Iran conducts this war, but I hope, you know, there is people within the Iranian government and military that are calculating these things. And, you know, Iran alone can withstand, yes, an attack, a first strike by the U.S. It can respond by destroying oil facilities or the bases of the Americans in the region. But I think it would be smarter for them to take first steps before the Americans take those first steps. Have the resistance in Iraq attack the American bases, for instance. Have Yemen attack the American bases before, because I don't want to see, I personally don't want to see Iran destroyed or important figures in Iran assassinated or Iranian people killed. And waiting for the attack by the Americans is not a good plan, definitely.
Thank you so much, Laith, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Thank you very much, Nima. See you soon.
See you soon. Take care.